First of all, you're all very welcome to Dublin. It's very unfortunate that you've arrived in the middle of our monsoon season. I gather some of you had difficulties getting out of Dublin Airport last night. I can tell you that the amount of rain that fell in this city in the last 24 hours... Where is that music coming from, by the way?
It's part of the shopping complex.
It's part of this White Elephant shopping complex, I've been told. But it's so bizarre. Anyway, we'll try and compete with it until they find the source and kill it. Anyway, I can tell you that the amount of rain that fell on the city over the last 24 hours was 76.5 millimeters, which is an all-time record for an August day in Dublin. I'm not sure we should be too happy about it. Anyway, whatever about the weather, Dublin is a very different city to what it was 20 years ago, as some of you in the audience will know very well, and others probably have guessed. It's very remarkable to recall that, in fact, in the mid-1980s, there was over 60 hectares of derelict land in the centre of Dublin. There were derelict sites all over the place, which required redevelopment. And it was not until 1991, which is really only 15 or 16 years ago, that the first purpose-built apartment block was built in the inner city, along the quays, at the western end of the Liffey Quays. And that, in itself, was amazing to see, but also it was followed by thousands and thousands of other apartments that were being built in the inner city area. And that in itself brought loads and loads of new people, particularly younger people, back into the inner city to live in an area that had been suffering catastrophic population decline since the 1920s. So the population of the inner city is now much higher than it was before, and it's about actually twice what it was in 1991. And it's set to continue rising. Our former Prime Minister, Bertie Ahern, when the boom got underway, he used to really like to count the number of tower cranes on the skyline. You know, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There were about 17 or 18 cranes at that stage in Dublin. And then the number of cranes, as the boom really got underway in the mid-1990s, the number of tower cranes expanded so much that we stopped even counting them, because there was development underway nearly everywhere in the city and in the suburbs as well. And there was an old joke, well, it's a Dublin taxi driver's remark, that there was so much going on in Dublin that these property developers, they'd build on your big toe if you let them. The pace of development in the city was frenetic. But the revival of the inner city, I don't think, should obscure in your minds the very essential fact that Dublin now has a commuter belt that extends out to 100 kilometers, which is about the same dimensions as the Los Angeles metropolitan area, but with only about a population of 1.2, 1.3 million. So that is something that is a fundamental fact about the way we live now. It also explains why there's so much traffic congestion in the city. There's a very inadequate public transport system, which is not really a system at all, in that nothing really joins up. The reason for the fact that there's so much housing on the periphery is very simple, is that housing in Dublin became so expensive that people could not afford to buy houses or apartments in the city at the height of the boom, particularly when the prices per square metre in Dublin were higher than they were in Paris and practically every other continental European city. And this was in the capital city of a country that is on the edge of Europe. So, you know, essentially, what was happening was kind of mad, certainly in terms of the values that were being assigned to property. The boom also, I think, did something to our psyche as Irish people and turned us into a really more self-centered, more selfish, less caring people than we used to be. And in fact, sometimes I wonder whether we are not finally the realization of Maggie Thatcher's demented vision of there being no such thing as society. But now that the boom is over, which is, I know a lot of architects are being laid off and so on, but I still think that the end of the boom is something that we should welcome, because it's going to inaugurate a period of recession. And in a period of recession, we can all begin to think about the legacy that we've created already and what we might do to improve things for the future when we have more time to think, which I think we will for the next few years. So I'm really glad about that. Anyway, I just wanted to start by introducing Siobhan Leaney. Siobhan is a well-known architect in Dublin. Herself and her partner, Michael McGarry, were responsible for the design of one of the most popular new pieces of public space in the city, which is the Liffey Boardwalk, which is greatly used and appreciated by people, especially when you try and get away from the traffic on the quays. There is now a refuge which Siobhan and Michael gave us at the instigation of the then city architect, Jim Barrett. So Siobhan is going to locate the Liffey in the landscape, and I've said to her that she shouldn't really speak for more than about 10 minutes. I'm very anxious to facilitate as much public participation as possible, and I know that many of you will have lots of questions, or some of you will have many questions, and I want you to be able to ask them before, or make any comment that you feel you want to do before this ends at about 2 o'clock. Siobhan.
Can you hear me?
Mic closer,
I'm told.
Yeah, that's it.
Fair enough. Okay, you've been welcomed in English. I'd like to welcome you all to Dublin in our own first language. Tá an áil to roimh go bailí aclia. Fíor chuin fáil to roimh. The name of the piece you see there in front of you is called Cuas an Olivia. Cuas is an Irish word and it means cavity. And Olivia is, I suppose, the romantic name given in literature to the major river in the city, the Liffey. The image again in front of you reminds you of the physical landscape that surrounds us. We are an island nation. The connection, I know most of you would have come in aeroplanes, but previous to air travel, the connection to the outer world, and that's a really important thing for an island nation, is the sea. So people came and went from this piece of land by boat. So the rationale, if you like, for the foundation of Dublin is not unique. It is safe anchorage for sailors and fresh water when they needed to get fresh water to survive. The Liffey, the major river in the city, there are about five or six rivers, the Camoch, the Poddle, the Dodder, the Talca, but the Liffey is the main one. It is the lifeblood. It is the natural physical force running through the heart of our city. It rises in the south, in the Wicklow Mountains, which is what you see there on that image. It turns its way westwards, it turns its way northwards, and then it goes into the sea east, into what is Dublin Bay, and actually the greater world in water terms. And I know you've seen plenty of that, but that's good too. If I move to the next image, there are some maps here. I'll be as brief as possible. The one on your left is a diagram which shows the estuary of the Liffey, Dublin Bay, and some of the surrounding rivers. I don't know if you can see it, but there are two quite thin lines in the blue where it necks into become narrow. Those two lines represent the width of the Liffey today relative to what it was over 1,000 years ago. And our bay has narrowed essentially because the what was the estuary of the river has over time, hundreds and hundreds of years, been filled in, and the river canalised and narrowed to what it is today. The map in the top middle is medieval map of Dublin, and you can see, for those of you who are maybe close enough to see it, you can see the fortified city. It's where Dublin Castle is. If you haven't been, I'm sure you'll go. There is a, if you like, a belly of water, which is actually where the Poddle and the Liffey come together. It's the place that was called Dublin, which is the origin of the English name Dublin. Dublin means black pool, concentration of water. There are other maps on that. I'll be very quick. The one on the top right is a Roke's map of the mid-1700s. The one on the bottom left is a 19th century map, which shows, I suppose, if you look at the map above, the one with the blue, it just shows the network over 1,000 years. Dublin, the foundation of Dublin is about 841, as we understand it to be. Norse settlement. Of course, there were native people before then, but as a place of settlement, it's from about 841. So the difference between, if you like, the top map, where the blue, and the bottom map, where there is just a network of streets, you can see that the spider's web of development over hundreds of years meant that, in a way, the reverse of the picture has happened. What was blue has become much narrower, and the concentration of habitation has actually increased north and south of the River Liffey. The diagram on your bottom right shows a large green body. That is the Phoenix Park. And it shows the River Liffey running east-west, and it shows Dublin Bay on the right. That'll just, if you like, give you a fix on the area of the Liffey that I will speak about. The map on the top right is, as I say, a John Roke's map, and the map just below that, again, for those of you who can see, is the most wonderful map because it shows the Liffey, and it shows it full of boats. And that's such an important thing to remember about the Liffey. As I said, it's lifeblood, life-giving. But it was also a very active mechanism in the city for commerce, for trade. People lived alongside it. They fished it, but boats came up into it. And over time, it was the raison d'etre for Dublin. Development north and south of its bay, of its banks, and a bay developing over time. The next image shows you some of the life of what was Dublin, full of boats. I will just briefly say to you that the image on, say, the bottom left was of 1870. And it shows that all along here would have been just full of boats, big sailing boats, ships, trading, cargo, merchandise, life, connection with the outside world. Just an incredible, lively element in our city. Our you know, part of the poetry, the mechanism, the working of what made this place to be here and to develop. Again, you can see boats in the bay. I mean, you still see boats in our bay. But the working element of our city was what was so fantastic in those kinds of images. Go to the next one. This image, again, is the Liffey, and it is looking, it's looking east. Those images were taken in the late 1990s. And Frank mentioned in his introduction that the city architect and the architect's department, Jim Barrett, came to us with an idea in the latter part of the 1990s, and it was for a boardwalk, possibly along the river. We thought, myself and my partner, thought it was a fantastic idea. Others thought it was mad. We thought it was just a great idea. But we said to him, it should actually be on the north side of the river, not the south. And the reason for that is very simple, because if it's on the north side, it'll get the sun. So in very simple terms, the reality of what made Jim and his team come up with this idea was that the quays and the river, though incredibly important, had, by the latter part of the 20th century, become incredibly dead. There was traffic routes either side, but no way in which you could enjoy this incredible life force in the city. Effectively, it had become that vacant void. So these are some images, you may go on it, I don't know if you've been, but I suppose they show the idea of this boardwalk, which was a 4 meter wide timber deck, which respected the important protected structures of the key walls of the city. But by, if you like, working parallel with them and the walls, our river doesn't curve, it bends. By understanding the nature of the river and the opportunities that it gave us for different ways of seeing and enjoying the river while respecting the existing environment, respecting the bridges. The idea was for as continuous as possible a walk over water on a timber board that separated you from the traffic Frank spoke about and gave you a place to sit in the sun. It's really as simple as that. Phase one of it happened and was opened before the end of the year 2000, and it was from Parliament Street Bridge to O'Connell Bridge. And given the popularity, or at least hopefully the success of it, it was decided to do a second length from O'Connell Bridge to Butt Bridge. So a simple idea. That's an image, a black and white image. There were previous images earlier, but that's a black and white image of the timber deck in the evening time over a still water. Very briefly, that's a project, and it's just about the way in which you can connect over water to elements in the city. Very briefly, it is an idea for a walkway which spanned the river and connected Memorial Park to that big park I mentioned earlier, the Phoenix Park. We move on to maybe the last project. And this is a proposal, and it's a current proposal. Not our idea, the idea of Barry Boland, who is director of the Liffey Cable Car Company. And it is an idea for a way of breathing life into the Liffey, using it as a way in which you can reimagine the city. And it is for a cable car that would go from Houston, essentially in the west side of the city, to Dublin Bay, to actually very near where we are now. And the idea is for 4 towers that would make, obviously, that link between the west and the east, and you travel over the Liffey in these cable cars. You enjoy views of the city, north, south, east and west, and you have a way of seeing it within the context of its landscape, the sea, and inevitably the connection, in your imagination at least, with the outside world. One small thing I would say, our river is very important for the reasons I've said. It's important to us emotionally, but it is not a wide river. It's actually quite a narrow river. And it's I suppose, difficult to make urban artifacts, urban infrastructure of a scale which is Siobhan. Memorable in the memorable in the sense that, for example, say bridges, say the Charles Bridge over the Moldau in Prague is, or some of the bridges over the Elbe or in Rotterdam, the Erasmus Bridge, they are massive rivers. And bridges and infrastructure that cross it become incredibly important in the mental mapping and the visual imagery of a city. Our city has a wonderful river, but it's a narrow river. And the cable car project, I suppose, is a way of considering the Liffey and its enclosure in a vertical dynamic rather than in a horizontal dynamic. Thank you very much.
I think it would be fair to add that project is not one that has won universal approval. There are contentious issues involved in it, which and a lot of people have taken opposing views. It's currently, or it's about to become, a planning application to the City Council. Our next speaker is Gary Boyd, who is a senior lecturer in the new School of Architecture, which has been established very recently in University College Cork, filling a gap that had existed in the second city of the Republic for a long number of years. Gary.
Thank you very much. And I'd just like to welcome everybody here from both inside and outside Ireland. And I think it's really interesting that we're going to form a kind of debate about this in a few minutes' time. So I'm going to try and make this as brief as possible, and I'm fully aware that what I can talk about is going to be very kind of broad brushstrokes as to what I see as some of the emerging trends in Dublin in the last 15 to 20 years. What I want to talk about is this notion, I think, of public city. The way I value cities, and the way I think is a really interesting way of thinking about cities, is defining how many things you can do in a city for nothing under total freedom. What spaces can you go to? Where can you be? How can you experience culture? How can you experience and access to space within the city centre? This is one of the reasons why I think the Boardwalk is a really very, very successful project, but quite unique in contemporary Dublin, because I would argue that Dublin has a paucity of public spaces, and this paucity of public spaces and the way it has developed under in the last 20 years under this kind of idea of profit motives has led to a kind of more and more, one would argue, of an exclusionary place. So the city centre of Dublin becomes a place which potentially is very, very undemocratic, because there's very few places you can go where you're not expected to consume. And even places like, I don't know if anybody knows, or many of you know who are from Europe, but even places like the historic Stephen's Green, it's a park, not a square. It's quite interesting, it's quite unique. In Europe, you'd have grand squares where people could gather, people could actually express political views and protest, etc. That doesn't happen in those kind of spaces. The only place it can and did happen is in places like O'Connell Street, which is nearby. And even recently, there was moves on behalf of the government to actually kind of limit the amount of public protest and manifestations that could actually take place on O'Connell Street. So we have this kind of weird situation where I think as Dublin became infinitely more wealthy, it actually became more and more kind of distinctive between rich and poor zones. And actually you can see it very clearly where we are now. And the difference just behind here, there's a series of very bad kind of social housing areas, and you find a kind of buffer zone, and at times expressed in as kind of extreme measures as walls between here and there. And you have these little pockets emerging, and sometimes this notion of urban apartheid can actually happen within buildings themselves, within actual housing buildings, where some of the housing has been given over to social housing, but how you access that is actually different from how you access the housing, which is for private kind of clients, if you like. So this is happening, and I think indicative of this is something I find really interesting and endlessly fascinating, that within the city centre, and those of you from Europe might not be aware of this, you might not have even experienced this before, but within the city centre, in common with, again, Great Britain, and in common with what emerged from Thatcher's Great Britain, is a series of kind of surveillance cameras which watch the public as they go about their everyday life. So it's really curious one would have this. And surveillance cameras just protect, in my opinion, just protect property. They just move crime. So kind of crime moves from the city centre into peripheral estates, into poor areas. And the city centre stays as this kind of zone of consumption, zones for middle class, perhaps even a zone of culture, but a zone of culture for a very specific clientele. So, for example, and I think I'm probably going to end on this, just to talk about, you know, Temple Bar, which is a zone in the city which, you know, was set up as a zone, you know, apparently of freedoms. Apparently we could go and have a kind of emerge from a kind of bohemian area within the city, but is now one of the most tightly controlled areas to do with surveillance in actually Western Europe. So what you have in the city centre of Dublin, a situation where it's actually, there's more surveillance than there was under Great British colonial rule, bizarrely, and watching your own people constantly. And moreover, I don't know if it happened or not, but when I was doing some research on this a few years ago, the responsibility for those who execute this surveillance and was being devolved from the Garda Síochána, which is the Irish National Police Force, to private companies. So you have the city centre largely policed by unanswerable kind of private companies, which I think in any level must be very curious, and in some level one could think about the city centre of Dublin acting kind of like a 19th century institution where everybody is almost an inmate. I'm going to finish there.
Still in touch with his architectural roots because he lectures in, are you still lecturing in UCD?
No.
Oh, sorry, you're not. Yeah, he's not double jobbing. Okay.
Out of touch with my architectural roots.
All right, Ciarán.
Thank you, Frank, and you're all welcome to Dublin. I was at a Yaza gathering 15 years ago now in Liège in Belgium, and it's an awfully long time ago, so it's good to see a new generation of Yaza participants here in Dublin. I want to start off with a quotation from 80 years ago from a guy called, I think, Andrew Peter from 1925, and he was describing Dublin. He said, "Dublin is a city of contrasts, intense loyalty, angry rebellion, fine buildings, wretched slums, some wealth and much poverty, pleasure-loving people, light of heart but bitter in hatred, gay and bright in the summer season, with a welcoming smile for the stranger and pilgrim." And I use that quotation because I still think Dublin is a city of huge contrasts. You'll see wealth in Dublin that you did not see 20 years ago, but there's still a huge amount of poverty. And I think Dublin is still a very divided city, no more so than in the area behind us here in Dublin's Docklands, where there's a lot of new jobs in the finance sector, but there's not perhaps as big a social mix as you might like to see in a new city quarter. And I think one of the challenge for all of us in architecture or in planning is to ensure that we do have a mix and that the city is a welcoming place for not only all its own inhabitants, but for visitors. And there's a real danger that we set up quarters for the tourists, quarters for the rich people, quarters for the poor people. And as Gary said, I think Temple Bar is a dangerous example of what I remember an Italian critic once calling l'architettura della domenica, the kind of place where you go on Sunday and lick an ice cream, or in Temple Bar's case, the place where you go and get very drunk on a Thursday, Lights. Friday, Saturday Lights. Night, or any other night of the week. So I think we should always be a little bit careful of zoning cities by the kind of use that they have, and that's a huge challenge for what we do. I guess I started off with my understanding of the city as an architect, and I was interested in how you put spaces together. And then I got more interested in communities. How do you make communities work? So I moved on into planning. And from there, I moved into politics, because you can have the best planning, but you need the political decisions to make it all happen as well. So I kind of went from the small spaces into the bigger spaces, and now I'm trying to work out how you put entire communities together and how you manage cities, how you manage different areas. And Dublin is a hugely different place. As Frank said, the population of Dublin throughout the 20th century went like that. And a bit like a Nike swoosh, it suddenly did that about 10 or 15 years ago. So instead of the population going down and down and down, suddenly 20,000 people moved back into the center of Dublin. And the people in the center, many of them decided to stay. So there's a lot more life, a lot more activity on the streets in Dublin. And I always remember 20 years ago, a member of the police stopping me and saying, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Oh, I'm from Dame Street, a street in the center of Dublin." And he said, "No, where are you really from?" And the assumption was that, well, you couldn't be living in Dublin at that time. So one of the remarkable things is that there has been a renaissance for the city of Dublin, and that there has been a lot of new life and new activity in the center. And also, there's been a lot more confidence here. Back then, 20 years ago, many of us left Ireland because there weren't jobs here. And then, slowly, people left, but they came back. And I think it brought with it a lot of experience from abroad, from Berlin or Barcelona or Boston. And the Dublin you see now has been influenced by all those different ideas that people of my generation brought back with them from abroad. And I think that's very important in understanding how the city works. I think for a city to work well, you've got to get the balance right. And I often think it's a bit like Goldilocks porridge. Not too hot, not too cold, but just right. And by that I mean, at the moment in Dublin, a lot of people are saying we need to go very high. We need tall buildings. They are the mark of a modern city. And then a lot of other people say, oh, we don't want high rise. We're happy with two stories, with three stories. And I think you need somewhere in the middle. And I love cities that have the hustle and bustle of and the vibrancy of medium densities, maybe five, six stories. I love cities like Amsterdam, like Barcelona. I've heard great things about cities like Helsinki. I've heard a lot about cities that just don't go completely for high rise and that aren't towns at very low density. So I think from a planning point of view, going for that level of urbanism is hugely important, because that brings with it the kind of activity, the kind of architecture, the kind of mixture that's hugely important. And I think in Dublin, we're slowly starting to do that. 25 years ago, we were building public housing like across the river there, the red brick stuff, only three stories high, right on the bank of the River Liffey. That's too low. You don't get the activity. It's like building in a small town in the countryside. You need to go up a bit. Not to the kind of junk that's behind you, that type of office block that is banal in its design and execution. But you've got to get the mixture right. And that's a huge challenge for you in your careers, to not be pushed down and not to be pushed up, to get the mixture right. And maybe that's me talking as a planner, but that's hugely important. And I want to really finish by talking about three things. Number one, the public space of the city is crucial. And as architects, we often just think about the building, and we look at the building, we don't draw what's left and right of it, we maybe don't think enough about the surroundings. I think it's hugely important that we think about the surroundings and that we design the public space around the building. Think about that really carefully. And your training as an architect, it prepares you for that. And don't let the bureaucrats and the planners dictate all of that. As architects, think about the surroundings and try and design how that will work, because that's crucial. That's the lifeblood of the city. The second thing, and obviously as a Green I'm going to mention this, is climate change. And climate change for Ireland, it'll bring a lot more extreme weather events. And I wouldn't be surprised if the rain that you saw yesterday could be typical of the kind of extremes that we may get in the future with climate change. So I think you have a huge duty to look at low carbon and zero carbon buildings. And from my experience in talking to architects and planners, we've a huge amount to learn. It's possible to have beautiful buildings that are low or zero carbon. It doesn't mean you've windmills and solar panels and all of that. It just means that they're well built, well insulated, and have good building systems. So they don't have to look like the green building of tomorrow, but they can be very low emissions. And I think that should be a huge part of your training, because the biggest challenge, I think, on the planet at the moment is to tackle climate change. And you've got to be thinking about that in everything that you design. And I know, having worked as an architect and having worked as a planner, you can do it. You can get it right. You can get communities where you don't have to drive everywhere, where you can walk and cycle. You can do that. You can build that. You can design architecture that has very low emissions. You can do that today. So it's within our grasp. It is possible. And the final thing I want to say is that it's hugely important, as you design buildings, as you design cities, as you design in the countryside, that you design for the needs of children. And I know that's probably me talking as a parent with young kids, but I think you should always think about the needs of children. And I think one of the downsides, one of the problems with a lot of the new quarter around us in the Docklands is that you don't see too many children. And I think their needs were not incorporated very early on at the design stage. But I think if we truly wish to design sustainable architecture or sustainable cities, we've got to provide for the needs of children at the very first stage. So that's it. Thank you very much for listening, and good luck with your time in here.
Where we're gathered here today used to be the Stack A warehouse of the Custom House docks. And it would have made, and the intention was to make it, a great modern art gallery. And that was something that it would have been ideally suited for. But instead, it's this kind of ersatz shopping mall, which probably won't last now because of the recession. One of those who strongly supported putting a modern art gallery in here was Robert Balla, who is one of our leading contemporary artists. He also trained as an architect in the DIT Bolton Street, but gave up architecture in favor of art, and also set design, for which he's very well known too. He's also a man who is fearless in terms of expressing his views, even when that has cost him dearly in some cases because of the political system that we have here. Bobby.
Thank you, Frank. I actually gave up architecture to become a musician.
Oh, sorry, yeah. I forgot that bit.
But I didn't stick at that too long either. I gave up the music to become eventually an artist. My greatest claim to fame as a musician was that when I retired in 1966, I sold my bass guitar to Phil Lynott, who went on to become Ireland's first rock superstar. So even if I didn't achieve great success, my guitar did. I come to this building today with very mixed emotions. In fact, this is my first time inside this building in 20 years. In 1988, the Custom House, just up the quays here, one of our finest 18th century buildings, was scheduled for restoration and renovation. And the architect of that project, David Slattery, approached me and said that since they were putting up a big scaffolding system outside, wouldn't it be a marvelous idea to paint murals over this scaffolding and make the scaffolding more interesting than just tarpaulins, etc. And I said, yeah, I thought that was a good idea. And we started working on the project. He got the builders to agree to sponsor a part of the project. We also got Crown Paints, who are a famous paint company, to sponsor the paint. And then, using my political contacts, we got 18 young people who came from the area just in here, which then and now is considered a marginalized area with high unemployment, huge social problems, etc. But 18 of those young people came to work with me on that mural project. I then got a loan of this building, this whole building, to do this mural project because it was derelict then. It was a derelict warehouse. And we used to come in here every day. The murals were actually were constructed from big panels, and we painted these panels in here over a 2 or 3 month period. And I remember at the time being extraordinarily impressed by this building. It's a very functional 19th century building, but it has a, I think you will agree, a great elegance about it. And at that time, the plans for this whole development around here were being launched. And one part of that project was to renovate this building as the new Museum of Modern Art in Dublin. And I remember, you know, having very strong personal relationship with the building, thinking, what a wonderful idea, how wonderful this building would be for a Museum of Modern Art. Unfortunately, I failed to take into account the vanity and the corruption of politicians. What happened was that our Taoiseach of the time, our Prime Minister of the time, Charles J. Haughey, was a man of great vanity. If you are French people here, they will recognize it in François Mitterrand, who I think Charles Haughey greatly modeled himself on. Yeah. He certainly bought his ties in Charvet in Paris. But Charles Haughey was going to be president of Europe in 1990, I think he wanted a great project to show off to all the European leaders when they came to Dublin. So in 1988, a decision was made, or maybe a little later, that renovating this could not be done in time, couldn't possibly be done in time, but they had an 17th century hospital, a British military hospital in Kilmainham, which they had just spent, I think, 26 million restoring, sitting pretty much unused up in Kilmainham. So a quick decision was made without consultation with anybody to change the siting of the Irish Museum of Modern Art from here, which is literally within 5 minutes walk from the city centre, to a place that you can only get to by taxis on the outskirts of the city centre. Because, of course, it could be turned around in double quick time, much to the damage to the actual 17th century structure. Walls were knocked down and all sorts of things were done to this wonderful old building. But to this day, that is where we have our Museum of Modern Art. There was an expose in the Irish Times last week showing the inadequacy of this location, because they've, believe it or not, the building is so inadequate for its use as a modern art gallery that they had to resort to storage containers in the car park to keep the paintings that weren't on display. And the paintings, many of them became damaged, because obviously a container in a car park is not a very good place to keep masterworks. Why I'm going on a bit about this is it seems to me to exemplify what's wrong with our planning process, what's wrong with those who are in, you know, who have authority in our society, the way they make decisions. They're made in an arbitrary fashion, often running against the advice of experts in that area. So we get an inadequate Museum of Modern Art in the wrong place, and then we get a shopping mall in a wonderful building in the right place, but who wants another shopping mall? I just think that it's a very good lesson of how things can go wrong. I'd just like to go on very to speak a little. Oh, I see.
The Cork supporters are going past. Going to Croke Park.
I just want to speak a little bit about Dublin, because there's no doubt about it, there's been great change in the last two decades. Dublin is, as a city, quite unique in that it is probably the most accurately described city in world literature. And here I speak of James Joyce's Ulysses, where he very accurately described Dublin in 1904. He replied to a question once. He said that if Dublin was destroyed, it could be rebuilt according to my book. The interesting thing about that for me is that my father grew up in that exact city. And when I grew up in Dublin in the 1950s, it was absolutely unchanged from that city of 1904. And that is one of the reasons why I get such pleasure from reading James Joyce's Ulysses and his depiction of Dublin. Because the shops he mentions in the book, I remember those shops, the streets. The city was absolutely unchanged. Then I got married, and time went on. My children grew up in a city that was totally changed from that city of Joyce's time. And then my grandchildren now will grow up in a city that is absolutely different, totally changed from the early part of the 20th century. So there really has been significant change. I think the speakers before me have pointed out the good aspects of that change, but there are undoubtedly huge downsides, and most of them associated, I think, with bad planning and corruption. I leave it there. Thank you.
Now, having limited the speakers, to give you an opportunity to comment or ask questions. That's what we're hoping that you will do. Does anyone want to comment? I'm not sure. Hugo, what is the position about microphones for the audience?
You don't have any, of course.
You don't? Okay. You'll just have to shout. Who's first? Who'd like to make a comment on what they've heard so far? Come on, somebody has to go first. I'll give a prize. Okay. There you are. Okay.
Or
Is this something that you've noticed since? Yes, but in Dublin, you've noticed this particularly. Yes. Okay. Yes, sorry. The question related to whether we have any great plans to sort out the traffic and transport problems in the city. I mean, I could go on about this myself, but I won't. Ciarán.
Yes, we do, but we...
But we probably
we have
can't
a long
afford
history.
Them.
We have a long history of making great plans and then putting them on the shelf and forgetting about them. Two very positive things have happened in the last few years. The first thing is we built a tunnel from the docks out to the motorway that goes to the west of Dublin. So you don't see very many big 18-wheel trucks on the quays. And if you were here 3 or 4 years ago, you would have seen lots of big trucks, noisy, really dangerous on both sides of the river. So that's one thing that has happened. The second thing is we built two light rail lines. The problem is they don't join up, but we hope that
that's
they will
join up.
That's
a metaphor for Dublin.
And there are now extensions to those light rail lines, and there is also plans for a metro that will go from the north of Dublin all the way down to the centre and hopefully on to the south. So there are some strong transport plans out there. Slowly, we're starting to invest in public transport. And one of the challenges for my party, the Greens in government, is to really push public transport, because our partners in government are much happier to see lots of roads. And we say, look, we want to spend 70% of the money on public transport, maybe 30% on roads. They would argue the reverse. So that's a huge challenge. And the other issue that's hugely important for me is the slow modes. The mark of a civilized city is the investment in pedestrian facilities and cycling. And if you look at a city like Barcelona, one-third of the outside space of the roads is dedicated to pedestrians. Here, very often, the footpaths are narrow and the roads are wide. So we need to give more space to the pedestrian and more space to the bicycle. And that's a huge challenge. So yes, there are plans to spend money on public transport. They are slow, they are ambitious, but I do think that we will see significant investment in the big public transport projects. But for me, the small projects, the kind of the lower speed limits, the cycle provision, the footpaths, those things are huge, huge. Well, a lot of people are simply driving to and from work during the week. That we don't have a strong network of buses that links up with the rail and light rail. So a huge amount is commuter traffic to and from work. And the challenge is to reform the bus service, get enough buses, get enough coordination, and to get an integrated ticket that works between all the networks. Those are immediate challenges.
It should also be pointed out that, of course, during one of the consequences of the economic boom was that loads and loads of people went out and bought cars and were driving around, you know, often in SUVs, in triumph, you know, celebrating their own economic success. And some of them, or many of them, wouldn't be caught dead on public transport, you know. I mean, that was one of the problems. So that, in a way, well, I'm talking particularly of ordinary buses. They're not into buses, and you couldn't persuade them to get on buses. And in fact, the major patrons of the bus network in Dublin during the whole boom period were the foreign nationals who came here to work. You know, Polish, Lithuanian, Latvian, others from around Europe, also from Africa and Latin America. The question was related to the boom and whether there was an improvement in social infrastructure to match the economic infrastructure, and the answer to that is no. Who's next?
Actually, sorry, can I go back just to respond to the transport thing again? Because Kieran's right, throughout kind of history, starting in the 19th century, with all sorts of grandiose plans for railways and pieces of infrastructure throughout Dublin. But one of the ones that most intrigues me, which was never acted upon, but maybe I can just suggest it as a little soupçon of an idea, was to actually demolish Temple Bar in its entirety and make a kind of some sort of amazing transport exchange there. And
that was the plan.
That was the plan. And yeah. In some ways, it might have been interesting. I know, Frank, you probably don't think so, but...
It was to be one of the biggest bus stations in Western Europe. The architects were Skidmore, Owings and Merrill, famous architectural practice
could
from America.
Could have been
and
amazing.
One of the reasons why Temple Bar happened, because I had a studio in that area for 13 years, one of the reasons Temple Bar happened was that they kept buying up properties all over Temple Bar to prepare for this megalopolis. And, of course, like all great plans in Ireland, it never happened. So suddenly you had this very large area in the south inner city, which was full of derelict properties. So when the scheme came in to create the Temple of Bars, they were all there, you know, all empty, ready to be used.
Well, in fairness, a lot of them weren't empty. A lot of them were occupied by artists. And alternative clothes shops and even places that used to sell old comics.
The problem, Frank, with that was when the change took place, the artists couldn't afford the rent.
That's true, yeah.
And sorry, had to leave.
Veggie restaurants as well. Who's next? Yes. The question is, what percent of the transport budget is spent on bicycles? Kieran?
Almost zero.
Yeah.
And... A recent item of controversy was that the advertising firm JC Deco have done a deal with the city whereby they removed some billboards, put up lots more, and I think they're giving us 150 bicycles. Now, the new billboards, the new ads have appeared, but there's no sign of the bicycles. And they're right in the middle of the footpaths, yeah. And they're an impediment to blind people. And somebody estimated that the JC Deco will get about €100,000 in revenue for every bicycle that they put in. So a very dodgy deal, I think, between the city council and the advertising firm to get some free bicycles. But no, realistically, a small amount of the budget has gone into cycling. There is some cycle lane infrastructure. There's one just out there on both sides of the quays. But the infrastructure is not integrated, coordinated, and there's good design and bad design. So not enough attention has been paid to the slow modes in the city, and we're suffering as a result of that. I mean, I cycled here, and there's not even a bicycle rack outside a renovated building that cost €45 million.
That's your bike there, isn't it?
Exactly.
There was another one there, yes? Could you stand up so that we can hear you? Thanks.
I have a question relating to Temple Bar. Just from my own personal experience, it feels like a bit of a fairground for the university centre. And from what you just said, I wonder if there's some kind of plan to bring that area where people go there as their city. And if there's any plans, how it could become less of a tourist trap.
The question was about Temple Bar and whether it was a real place or just a fairground. And as a resident of Temple Bar, I suppose I have to respond to that. It's not a real place. Most of the bars are full of tourists. Hardly anyone from Dublin drinks in any of the major bars in the area. The mission of the state company that was set up to establish or develop Temple Bar in the early 1990s was to develop a small business, residential and cultural precinct. But in fact, what happened was that the only trade in Temple Bar that developed a critical mass was the licensed trade, in other words, the publicans. So every small little bar in the area became a mega bar. There was one bar that was just the size of two little rooms, and it now occupies an area of about 1,000 square meters. So, you know, that created a critical mass to turn Temple Bar into a drinking destination, you know, so that it became the temple of bars, as Robert has said. Did you say that?
I think.
Oh no, you said that. You did say that.
Well, no, Robert said.
Okay, and so for us as residents, we find ourselves fighting, if you like, on a number of fronts, particularly in relation to the use of amplified noise from the venues, which many of the pubs have become. And it's very difficult at the moment because we don't really have effective noise control legislation as you would have in, say, most continental European countries. So, you know, there's a balance that still needs to be struck, in other words, in Temple Bar. And it nauseates me when, you know, planners and architects come into Dublin from abroad and just give awards on the basis of just looking at buildings in complete abstraction from how the buildings are used and what the consequences of those uses are, the knock-on consequences in terms of not just the fabric of the area, but also the life of the area.
Frank, Ciarán. If I might add, I think there's a very important lesson for architects from Temple Bar. It was an old district of the city, but there was a lot of dereliction. And a master plan was prepared by a group of architects. I think, Siobhan, you were part of that. And there were proposals to put in somewhere between 10 and 20 large cultural centres in Temple Bar. Cinema, art gallery, artist studios, museum or gallery of photography. Some fantastic architecture. And almost all of that happened. And the architects built some very beautiful buildings that are worth visiting, some renovations, some new build. But the big issue was that the pubs got bigger and bigger and bigger. So while the architects designed some beautiful insertions in the old fabric of the city, the big issue politically or from a planning perspective was that the pubs just exploded. And now Temple Bar is nice enough during the day, and the cultural facilities are fantastic. I go to the movies down there, and I go to the galleries. They're great. But come 6 o'clock, get your kids out, because there'll be groups of English stag parties getting really, really drunk, vomiting and puking their way through all the bars. I mean, look.
Not just English. Irish too.
It's a mix of everything, but I think it shows you where architecture can succeed and where architecture maybe doesn't always take in the complexity of social and economic issues.
Go ahead.
Can I say something?
Yeah. I think there's another, I suppose, interesting thing just in relation to the Temple Bar issue. And yes, McGarry and Aney Architects were part of Group 91 Architects, which the group of architects who won the competition, the international competition for the framework plan for Temple Bar. And Group 91's thinking was very clear about the importance of the river in the city and the fact that though the river is part of its lifeblood, it is also a divider. There were very few bridges along the length of the river. We've had quite a number since. And as part of the Group 91 framework plan, there was to be a new pedestrian bridge which linked directly into one of the new squares as part of the Group 91 project. And for reasons which is not useful to go into now, that bridge on that particular location never got built. So it meant that the new square proposed, which did get built, which is at Meeting House Square, instead of it having a direct connection through a bridge across to the north side of the city, so that you had, if you like, a new connector between north and south, you know, lifeblood of people crossing the river into the heart of this quarter. That simply didn't happen, and that square is effectively, it's a gated square, which is a huge pity for the city. So the issue of infrastructure, the issue of force lines, the issue of the network of things that connect parts of the city and the consequence of those structural force line decisions are hugely significant.
And by the way, just to clarify, that's a distance of only about 20 metres.
The one across the... No,
the difference in the alignment of the two bridges.
Oh, yes.
About 20 metres in the difference, that's all.
That's
but 20 metres, even 20 metres, where you put a bridge, particularly where you put a bridge, can be absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
May I say something?
Yes.
Could I just say one final thing about Temple Bar? And, you know, I don't think we should be too hard on Temple Bar. Others mentioned, it's a nice place to go in the day, etc., but perhaps to be avoided late at night. But the reason why I think it has ended up in this difficult situation is because the powers that be, for whatever reason, have allowed Temple Bar to be run entirely according to the profit motive, the free market system. And it's interesting, if you look at the tally in terms of the infrastructure of Temple Bar, as Frank said, the bars have expanded, profited, etc. The cultural infrastructure, which as Ciarán mentioned, some fine buildings, etc., a lot of those have fallen by the wayside because they could not survive in a free market system. So I think that whereas the original planning might have been fine, the follow-through failed Temple Bar and failed Dublin.
Down at the back. Did you want to? Yeah? Shout. Sorry, I missed one key word there.
Who bar big business?
Who bar big business has a vision for the city?
Frank MacDonald.
go on.
Who has a vision for the city? The planners?
I think some of the local authorities do. I think some of the architects and planners in those local authorities do. I think there's been some good debates over the last few years through the Architectural Association of Ireland, and indeed through a forum that the Dublin Docklands Authority held in Temple Bar about a year ago. So I think there are visions, I think there are ideas out there. My regret is that a lot of the vision relates to the centre of Dublin, and I think a lot of the new communities that we're building need an awful lot of vision. And maybe we get preoccupied by the centre and we should spend more time thinking about the periphery. And I think particularly as we put in place metros and light rail lines, it's crucial that we get good densities and good design at the transport nodes. Now, that's not very sexy. It's easier dealing with this or that. But to talk about the periphery is hugely important. But I think, actually, some of the local authorities, and indeed some of the transport agencies like the Rail Procurement Authority, do have a fairly strong vision as to how the city should develop.
Yes. Could you just speak up, shout a little bit?
Yeah, I would like to know what happened to the project in Temple Bar about the green building, because it's the first eco building in Arkham.
The green building. Well.
Sorry, I've been doing a bit of research about that.
Yes.
Green building, and it's difficult to get information.
Well, I'm not surprised in a way. The question related to the green building in Temple Bar, which was completed in 1994, which was a very early project, you know, as a kind of a demonstration project for what could be done. The green building was heavily researched by Temple Bar Properties, the state agency that was responsible for the development of the area. It incorporated solar panels on the roof, also three wind turbines, which were very emblematic of, you know, it's the intentions of the project. Also a heat pump system, you know, plugging into the warm water down below ground, and various other features as well. I mean, for example, none of the apartments, the eight apartments upstairs, have baths, because it was regarded as that baths were too wasteful of water, so they only have showers. But one of the things that happened within a year of the completion of the building was that the wind turbines had to be tethered because they were making too much vibration on the roof of the penthouse flats, and the people who lived in the penthouse flats complained about the vibration and the noise that it created. So the wind turbines on the roof of the green building are actually rusting away. They haven't really been used for the last, I would say, not for the last 10 years, at least. So the building is a bit of a sham, actually. That's the truth.
I think that's too strong a criticism. The building is working well. It's a very low-energy building. And a point I made earlier is that we shouldn't be preoccupied by windmills and solar panels. That building has high levels of insulation, and it works quite well. It doesn't need all the stuff that we traditionally think is green on the roof. And for me, yeah, it doesn't, the bells and whistles, as Robert was saying, it works well. It's also a mixed-use building. Apartments on the upper floors, offices on the first floor, and retail on the ground floor and basement. It was a furniture shop, I think that just closed recently. But it is, for me, it's a good mixed-use building. And it is a low-energy building, and that's hugely important. And there is, I was looking at some energy performance information on the web about it recently, so there is info. We can talk about it afterwards.
Yeah. I think that would be like a first attempt to do an eco-building and learn from the mistakes and improve more things. I think that the noise is vibrations, something from the wings upstairs, it would be removed and put a
roof. Yes,
no,
yes.
No, you're right, and at the moment everybody says, oh, I'll get a windmill for my roof and it'll be fine. And there are DIY stores selling windmills. When people ask me, what do I do with my house? I say, look, insulation, insulation, insulation. In Ireland's climate, you need to get the insulation right, the heating system, get that right, but be careful not to look for the cartoon green stuff and think that that's the answer. And I think for yourselves in your careers, again, I see proposals full of windmills, and I say, well, what's the energy management systems like in this building? That's much more important than any God's amount of windmills strewn across it.
Fair enough. Front row.
That usually happens
The question was whether Dublin had become a better place for all of its citizens as a result of the economic boom that happened over about 10 to 12 years. And who wants to answer that?
Well, I'll briefly answer that by saying no. And the statistics are there to bear it out. Ireland, like every other country that experiences a great economic development, etc., the gap between the haves and the have-nots has increased dramatically in Ireland. So even though there are a lot of people who are a lot wealthier, and some think that happiness comes with wealth, I'm not so sure about that, but shall we say there are a lot more wealthier people who are, hopefully for their sakes, happier. But on the other hand, there are a lot more people who've been left behind. There's a real serious problem with homelessness in Dublin. There are marginalized communities. And now, with the recession, these people are really ill-prepared to deal with that situation. So I don't think equality has not been one of the byproducts of the economic boom.
Now, I just like to, probably in the main agree with Robert and suggest that perhaps it's something you could have a look at yourselves if you have time when you're staying in Dublin to go out to the periphery and have a look at what's happening there, because where you are at the moment is a little bit of a kind of very, very sanitized, safe consumer zone, and all of Dublin is not like what you see here, and there's bits of it which are as deprived as any place you'll see in Europe and haven't improved at all in the last 15 to 20 years. And moreover, what's quite interesting for me is how this kind of influx of wealth has kind of shifted morality in Ireland and shifted kind of what could have been described as the kind of Catholic morality. So for example, and I don't want to go back to Temple Bar, but there was an area which was very, very similar to Temple Bar, which is very close to here, called the Monto, which was described in James Joyce's Ulysses as well as Nighttown. And it was suppressed in the 1920s because it involved basically drinking, carousing, and sexual adventure. Then you have Temple Bar, which is more or less encouraged to a certain degree because drinking, carousing, and sexual adventure are now very, very popular and very, very profitable within the city. So they're now okay. It's a very curious kind of thing. If you go to where Monto was, you can see it's almost entirely disappeared. In fact, streets were erased because it was considered so incredibly louche. That louche world is now upon us and encouraged.
The names were all changed. Yes, you had a question. We've got only one other, that's it, and then we have to stop.
Can I go on?
Yes, of course you can. Yeah.
Sorry, Frank, sorry. I know I'm speaking far too much here, but I think we have to be...
You're a politician.
Yeah, I know. I'd be quite careful about saying whether Dublin is a better or worse place in 20 years. 20 years ago, when I was first elected as a councillor, there was public housing with no bathrooms and no hot water in the city. That's not the case anymore. There were flat blocks with 80% unemployment. It's a lot lower now. I think the level of employment in very disadvantaged or socially excluded areas has risen dramatically. I think the level of education in those areas has also risen dramatically. So, yeah, there's a lot more wealth out there. There's the difference between the richest and the poorest is probably bigger. But for the least well-off in society, there has been a dramatic improvement in access to education, in housing quality, in employment. So I think we have to be really careful about saying, has it got better or worse? I think for the people I represented for 12 years in local authority housing in the South Inner City, things have improved. Sure, there's new problems of obesity, of drunkenness, of all sorts of other issues, but the bottom line for me is I think things have improved for the least well-off in society. I'm not saying it's magic, but I think it has improved.
I think it's also only fair to say that, in my view at least, during the last 10 years maybe, the tenure of the previous city architect and the previous planner, I think there was a focus on the importance And we have just a new city architect now, and she's just started, so there's no way in which I could comment on her vision. But the previous one and the previous city planner, and, you know, planners within city council, I think there was a focus on the importance of the public domain. And to go back to the comment that was made about Margaret Thatcher's dreadful comment about there being no such thing as society, fundamental to the life of a city and to the expression of a city and a nation is its the value it places on the public domain, because that is the expression of society. And cities are the physical manifestation, if you like, of the importance of that expression. And the work that was done during that time in relation to, say, the boardwalk project that was mentioned, work that was done to O'Connell Street, spire, like it or not, is not the issue. Just the fact that there was a commitment, that there was a commitment to say the public domain in this city is critical to its life and to its expression. And I think that did actually happen during the period in which we're talking about. And hopefully it will happen much more into the future.
We've got one final question here. Yes. Could you stand up stand up and shout?
Sorry, could I just cut in for 1 second there?
Yes.
So the project, for example, about the cable car, and it is clearly...
No, hold on a second now, Siobhan. No, stop.
Sorry, no,
First of all,
okay, I'm sorry.
I have to say what the question is to everybody else, because you didn't hear it. The question was, to what extent does tourism feature in planning for the city, in a nutshell? And Siobhan, you're not going to go on with the marketing program for the cable car.
No, the only thing I was going to say was it is conceived by the promoter, and it's his idea, as a tourist infrastructure project. That's all I was going to say.
Yeah. Okay. Does anybody else want to comment on the tourism aspect? No?
No.
Of course we welcome visitors. You know, what else could you do? The Guinness Storehouse is the biggest single tourist attraction in the city, and it attracts, I think it's over 900,000 visitors per annum, which is extraordinary and way, way ahead of any other attraction in the city.
Do you know what the second one is?
What's the second one?
The second most popular visitor attraction in Dublin is the Jemison Distillery.
I thought it was the zoo myself, but however.
One of the things that fascinates me about tourism is how countries or regions, how they market their tourism and the relationship between what they market and the reality. Years ago in Ireland, one of the popular postcards showed a donkey with a small child gathering turf. It wasn't exactly typical of Ireland 30 years ago, whatever, about 100 years ago. At the moment, the Guinness store, it's a completely artificial attraction. They don't make Guinness in that place. And yet 30 years ago, you could go to Guinness's and actually see the process where they made the beer. Now it's simply an abstraction. It's not a real version of tourism. And even now, the way we market Ireland, we talk an awful lot about how nice the Irish are, and there they are talking to you in the restaurant. I think most of the people working in restaurants or in bars now aren't Irish. So I think we've got to be very careful about how we market what Ireland is. And Ireland has changed really dramatically. We didn't talk about immigration during this discussion, but there's been a huge amount of immigration. And you're more likely to be served by a Chinese person in a bar, in Temple Bar, than by an Irish person. And if you're looking for a nice small bar with a fire in the corner and an old Irish guy serving you, I don't think you'll find it in Temple Bar these days,
or
for better or worse.
Or anywhere. Did you
you want to say something?
No, I was just going to say that it's because it's quite near my studio. The Jemison Old Distillery, which is a big tourist attraction, doesn't make any whiskey. The whiskey in Ireland is made in County Cork.
A thing that looks like a chemical factory.
Tourism is a deceptive industry, shall I say.
I think, Ireland does depend massively on tourist income to survive, and I think that has had and will continue to have a kind of detrimental effect on the democracy of the city, because when you market a place, you market through imagery, etc., which describes it as a safe place to be, when you can see cultural objects, where you can have a nice drink, etc., inevitably, tourists are not supposed to see homeless people, they're not supposed to see drug addicts, they're not supposed to see urban contradictions. So tourism, as far as I'm concerned, is a necessary kind of correlative to the notion of surveillance and of clearing the streets of all these contradictions to make it safe and acceptable for tourists, which I think is not a democratic process in particular.
Okay. Listen, thank you very much for coming along. I want to thank the panelists for their contributions as well. And I hope you enjoyed it. And I'll hand back over to Hugo for, I hope that's what I'm supposed to do. Just to tell you about you, the next thing on the agenda are the walking tours. And all we can do is cross our fingers and hope it doesn't rain cats and dogs. Thank you very much.